Well, everyone's getting seated. I'll begin. My name's Amy McDonald. I'm chairwoman of the Penn New England, the world's largest and oldest writers organization. We are about protecting freedom of expression, practiced liberally at Fenway Park, Gillette Stadium, and the Garden, and celebrating literature, which is why we're so happy to be back at the Boston Book Festival. Isn't Boston the greatest sports town in the world? I also want to give a shout out to Kurt and Mary Cerulli, who co-sponsored this panel with us, and we're grateful for them. They are funding our Penn Cerulli Award for Literary Excellence in Sports Writing this year, and for funding the Penn's Sports Writing Hall of Fame. If you go to the Penn New England booth in Copley Square, we have ballots. Hall of Fame is going to have the best sports writing books in it. So please come by our booth and check off who you think should be in this Hall of Fame. Talking about everybody's favorite, dubbed the quintessential American sports writer, Bob Ryan began his career on the Celtics beat for the Globe. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including Drive, The Story of My Life, co-written with Larry Bird, and The Best of Sport, classic writing from the golden era of sports. His career spans more than 40 years, and he has received numerous awards, including National Sports Writer for the Year from the Associated Press. A couple of homeworking assignments. Books will be signed afterwards. Cell phones off. Please fill out the surveys on your table. Bob, on to you.
Thank you very much. Well, welcome, and thank you for coming. A terrific turnout here. I'm very pleased to see that. I'm really honored to be here with these distinguished people, and I'm going to introduce them starting on my far left. Three people here who are represented in this year's edition of Best American Sports Writing, and the first one to my left is a man who I've known for a long time personally, and also known as a listener to the award-winning show Only a Game, heard each weekend on NPR, locally on WBUR at 7 a.m., and a man who is a writer in residence at Curry College, a novelist, and a all-around literary savant, Mr. Bill Littlefield. To my immediate left is the gentleman who is most responsible for the whole reason we're here today, because it's his book. This gentleman is he's an editor, he's an author, he's a sports historian, and he is the grand poobah editor of Best American Sports Writing, Mr. Glenn Stout. To my immediate right, someone who has written a story about a bland personality. I don't know how he ever injected any life into Kurt Schilling, but we will get to that in great detail, I am sure. But from Boston Magazine and a representative for a terrific story about Kurt Schilling and the demise of 38 Studios, Mr. Jason Schwartz. To my far right, a young lady who has written a truly spellbinding story in this compilation. First time we've met, I'm very pleased to introduce to you Ms. Nicole Pasulka. Well, I'll start with Glenn, and just I think the need for those of you who I'm not sure everybody is equally well versed in what the whole concept of history of and purpose of, if you will, Best American Sports Writing. And so I'd like a little expository discourse here from Mr. Stout about the whole project and how it's evolved for you.
That's a big question, but I'll try to answer short. Almost 25 years ago, I was working across the street over at the Boston Public Library, and I got a message from my agent at that time saying that someone from Houghton Mifflin wanted to talk about this new series they were doing called The Best American Sports Writing. They'd asked her if she knew an agent who might have an author, because she was better known as being an agent of cookbook authors, and I was the one author who was not a cookbook author that she had on her stable. And she said, wait, I have someone. And recommended me, and I went over and I met with the editor, Stephen Lewers, who was the editor at Houghton Mifflin, about and talked about the book, and they asked me to put a sample together. I had the great fortune of knowing, which they didn't, that there'd been this other series that had just ended called Best Sports Stories that had existed for about 50 years. So I went through those and picked out the really good stories from there. And I worked at the Boston Public Library, where all the books and magazines were, and I picked some more recent material from there. And I gave them the sample and said, what do you think? And they said, you're on. And it kind of went from there. The one imprint I've had on the series is I said at the very beginning we should call it Best American Sports Writing, two words, rather than sports writing, one word. Because if we did that, we could have sports writing, one word, but we could also have writing by people who were not sports writers, who were just wonderful writers who happened to write about sports. And so if there's any legacy of mine in the book, other than the fact that now I need reading glasses, it's that one.
Well, it's very interesting that because that, in fact, is the nature of the three individuals that we have here today. They're all sports-oriented writers, and as opposed to people who are exclusively sports writers, as I am. And it does show up, obviously, in the quality of work. I want to start with Bill for the simple reason that it struck me, and maybe I'm wrong, there were 26 stories in the book, 26 stories this year. And they can be broken down in various categories. I want to get into that, too. But of all the stories, it struck me that perhaps, Bill, you are the one author here whose story idea fell out of the sky, as opposed to something that you sought and nurtured. Am I correct?
And yes.
Bill's story is called The Gym at Third and Ross. And I'll let him tell you what it's about and how it came about.
That's a big question.
I'll try and do the short answer as well. As host of Only a Game, I make occasional trips to different places, and the idea is that I'll be there for about 4 hours and come back with three stories. And so that was a joke.
Comes back with five.
Right, yeah. So we had a trip scheduled for Pittsburgh, and the first two stories were easy. The Pittsburgh Penguins wanted to build a new building to play hockey in, and Pittsburgh was out of money, but I knew that somehow they'd scrape up the money for an arena, because somehow they always do. And then the second story was the Duquesne basketball team, five members of which had been shot right before the season, and yet they went on and played the season. Happily, none of them died. One of them was quite seriously injured. But the story was charming in some ways to me, because basically what the coach out there did was he put up posters around the Duquesne campus that said, if you'd ever played basketball, I'd like to talk to you. One of the kids that he got was a kid who'd played a little high school basketball and then decided that his future was really in rock and roll music. So he grew his hair out and started playing the guitar. But he saw the sign, and he walked into the coach's office, and the coach said, who the hell are you? And he said, I used to play a little basketball. And the coach said, if you get a haircut, you're my point guard. So anyway, we didn't have a third story until one of the producers at Only a Game found Jimmy Savetic, who's an ex-police officer who runs a gym. And Jimmy was going to put on a Golden Gloves tournament, and it happened that it was going to coincide with my visit to Pittsburgh. So I called him up, and he said, yeah, you can come out. He said, it'd be great. I got the next heavyweight champion here, Russian kid. And I got an ex-con. He's 65 years old. He holds the mitts. And I used to be a police officer, so you know I'll introduce you to the ex-commie, the ex-cop, and the ex-con. It'll be terrific. And he said, we got the mayor. He comes in here. You can meet the mayor. And we got a ring girl. She comes in. I'll tell her to dress for work. I said, geez, this story is going to write itself. This sounds pretty good to me. So I said, okay, we set it up. And he said, call me when you get to the airport. All right. So I flew into Pittsburgh. I called Jimmy, and he picked up the phone. I said, this is Bill Littlefield from NPR. And he said, who? And I said, it's Bill Littlefield. You got a boxing tournament. You got a Golden Gloves thing tonight. Oh, geez, he said, I had to cancel that. So I didn't know whether I had a story. Well, I ended up spending the better part of 3 days with Jimmy, and I did do a radio story. And then I had a friendship with Jimmy. So every once in a while, I'd call him, see how he was doing. Jimmy doesn't believe in the internet. And so we'd talk, and after a while, I had all, he's telling me all these stories, and he's doing all these things, and he's a poet, too, but on top of everything else. And I got to thinking, I thought, gee, we really didn't do justice to Jimmy in that radio story. We couldn't, because radio stories can't be long enough. So I just sat down, and I wrote the story, and I put it up on the Only a Gam website. And I heard from all three of the people who read it. And two of them liked it a good deal. And so I sent it off to Glenn. I figured, what the hell? And it got picked, so that was pretty good. It was pretty good.
Well, I have to tell you, no story ever, quote, writes itself. It's a phrase we writers like to use sometimes. But because what he does with it, you'll enjoy it immensely. And his use of the dialogue is almost, I would say, Runyon-esque. And it's really one of my absolute favorite stories in the whole anthology. Now, Jason, I'm making a little joke about Kurt Schilling's rather bombastic personality. But first, simply this. Was this something you sought out, or were you assigned this story?
It was a conversation with my editor. We got on a little late, actually. We sort of waited and sort of watched what was going on. This is about his video game company that sort of spectacularly collapsed last summer. And we were sitting there going, you know, there are 400 really unhappy employees right now. Some, you know, surely someone's going to, you know, interview them, like, get the story of what happened. And it just sort of didn't happen for a couple of weeks, so then we jumped in.
And you found him how accommodating, shall we say?
Kurt? Yeah, he's a quiet guy, like you said. You know, he's very honest. It's, you know, and he had done, you know, I think by what most people would say is a pretty bad thing, running this company into the ground, but more specifically, the way he left his employees, really hung them out to dry, didn't give them any sense that the company was going under. So all of a sudden, you had 400 people coming into work, not getting paid, no health care. Seven of them got stuck with old mortgages that they thought the company had taken care of through sort of a third party. It was really a disaster. I mean, there was one pregnant woman who found out her health care was gone from her doctor. So it was interesting squaring this, you know, really gregarious, you know, outgoing guy who, frankly, I talked to a lot of employees, and many of them thought he was a great boss, who had just done this really terrible thing to a lot of people.
I can verify that great boss thing. In February of 2012, I happened to have a conversation with one of those employees who had uprooted himself from California, had been recruited. I don't know exactly what his area of expertise was, but he was a skilled person and that would be of great benefit to the game world industry, and he was recruited and hired. And he told me at that time, February of 2012, best boss I ever had. He said, I love working for this company. He's generous. He's enthusiastic. He's it's wonderful. So I had that in mind. I told everybody this so that, you know, that I, you know, they would have any interest in it. So when the company went belly up, it floored me in that sense. I was walking around thinking this thing. Also, you didn't make any mention of this in the story, mm-hmm. but there was a review of that first game mm-hmm. in the New York Times. No. I don't see how this plays out. I want to see your reaction to this. I don't know if there was a review in the art section of the New York Times of the first game that they did produce. Mm-hmm. Had Kurt Schilling personally written out a check for $1 million to the reviewer for a positive review, he could not have elicited a more glowing review of that game. And with that in mind, and with the conversation I had with this person in mind, I was more than floored by the realization by the news that it took place. How much buzz was there? Did you ever pick up on that review of the first game?
Right. So
Kingdom of Amalur, is that the one?
Yeah, something like that. Kingdom.
I'm not a video game person, so I have no idea.
First to sort of back up a little, what Kurt Schilling was trying to build was something called a massively multiplayer online role playing game. Or MMO, it's like this big, giant, you know, universe, basically, where you have thousands, if not millions of people interacting in this space. That's what he set out to do. It's pretty much the most complicated type of video game you could build. The movie equivalent would be like doing Avengers or Avatar or something like that. And this is a guy who'd never, you know, made a video game before. Like halfway through that, you know, his company was sort of going along, and they saw another video game company that was struggling in Baltimore, called Big Huge Games, that was available for really cheap and had some technology they could use. So they bought Big Huge Games, which was working on, you know, this game. The Kingdom's Mammaler, which was a single-player game. I'm sorry to get sort of video game nerdy on a sports crowd. This was a single-player game, sort of like what you put in Nintendo or PlayStation or whatever else, much simpler, more straightforward. All the work, really, for it had come out of big, huge games in Baltimore. What Schilling had done is basically bought them and sort of put the wallpaper over. Mm-hmm. So that's probably why I got good reviews.
Okay, well, it got a phenomenal review anyway. Now, Nicole, I was envious of you for one simple reason, and your story. You had to go to Hawaii to get it. Yeah. So that was good. It's not a sports story. I will say that. It tangentially involves a surfer, but this is a story, in my judgment, correct me if I'm wrong, about Hawaiian culture, Hawaiian politics, and Hawaiian history, that involves a fascinating centerpiece, which is a surfer named Eddie Aikau. Go ahead.
It's funny, when I got the email from Glenn, I forwarded it to my editor with like a lot of exclamation points, and I was like, I thought this was a travel story. Like, I had no...
So you didn't even frame it in your mind in that sense?
No, gosh, no. I mean, it's funny. I did. So the story of Eddie Aikau... he was like a Hawaiian big wave surfer in the 1960s and 70s, legendary locally, who became later on a really sort of fervent Hawaiian nationalist, like an activist, to try to bring back like Hawaiian culture and recognize surfing as like part of a longer tradition. And he died in this really tragic canoe. He died on a double-hulled canoe that they were trying to navigate from Hawaii to Tahiti by the stars, so to prove that Polynesians... thousands of years ago, that's how they had gotten to Hawaii, to disprove like some racist ideas that it was an accident that people ended up in Hawaii. But he died trying to save the crew of the entire boat. It's like really, it's really emotional, right? Mm-hmm. But so I got really into surfing. I thought about surfing a lot. I read a lot about waves and about like, I wanted to understand how surfing happened. So that, it put that in perspective for me, as the sport was really important to the story, but it was not ever how I contextualize the piece that I was writing now. Because it's also about me being in Hawaii and learning about tourism.
So how difficult a project did it turn out to be for you?
Very difficult, yeah. The surfing part was not difficult necessarily, because there's a lot out there about surfing. There's a lot of people who are really passionate about it, and there's been some great writing about it, even waves, you know? And it is a persistent fascination, I think, for some sports writers, but the project itself was difficult because it involved my learning process about Hawaiian culture and my understanding of how, like, I had been writing for a tourism company in Hawaii, and so it was also trying to understand what I had been doing.
Did you develop a lot more empathy for the basis of their story about their, you know, about how America, you know, about the, all the history of the 19th century, the upheaval of the king, how we took over.
Yeah.
Our hands are a little bit messy here on this one, quite clearly.
Yeah, and totally.
Which I don't remember reading in my grade school history at all.
Right, me neither.
No, not at all.
No, the Hawaiians were thrilled to become the 50th state.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is really, it's powerful. It's really powerful.
I think while I was writing this tourism content, I was developing that empathy or getting a sense of kind of where the, I don't know if this ever happens to you guys, you just see something and you're like, I don't know, this doesn't feel right, and then you go deeper in, right? That's sort of what I did. And Eddie specifically was this really transfixing, amazing, mysterious character who, learning more about him was a way to learn more about the tension, especially during the 1960s and 70s, especially around surfing, which there were Australians who were taking over the beaches in Hawaii. And then there was a lot of conflict around that. And Eddie was this perfect person who, like, wanted everyone to get along, but also really wanted Hawaiian culture to be preserved and kind of celebrated.
Now, Mr. Littlefield, in addition to being represented in this anthology, is a past guest editor of said anthology. So I want to ask him to go over what it was like, the process. And in fact, I know Bill's, I asked Bill to do a judge a contest for me once too, a writing contest of college basketball writers. And but how you know, intense and difficult a process did you find when you were asked to, you know, be the guy to salute the people?
Well, first of all, since there are some Penn New England people here associated with this entire endeavor, I will say that it was not nearly as hard as it was being a judge in their contest, where every day would see the postman bring between 400 and 600 books to my door. But That was fun too. But it was great because Glenn and I knew each other. Glenn and I had lots of discussions. So the first time I met Glenn, he was standing outside Fenway Park in a homemade baseball jersey with a cheap PA and a microphone reading baseball poetry while, while drunks came by and lobbed vegetables and empty beer cans at him.
I was drinking too, though. Well, to be fair.
Certain protective camouflage. But anyway, I went and did a story about this idiot sitting outside Fenway Park reading baseball poems. And we found out that we had a lot of baseball poems in common that we liked, and I sent him some of mine, and the next year he read them outside Fenway Park. So working with Glenn was pure pleasure. And we knew each other, so there wasn't any of this, I wonder if this guy's going to appreciate my taste and this and that. It's interesting. One thing I remember very clearly from that process, when Glenn sent me the first packet of stuff, the piece on top was an essay by a wonderful writer named J.R. Moringer, and you may recognize his name because he's the editor of this edition. And Glenn said, I'm only going to say one thing. Please give this essay real consideration. I think it's the best sports-related essay I've ever read.
And so, I hadn't even read it because I stopped after the first page.
Right.
And I said, this is so good, I don't even need to read anymore.
Right, right. And he was right. It's a terrific story. Look it up. It's
Resurrecting
the Champ, and it's in the 1998 edition of Best American Sports Writing. But we had a lot of fun. I really enjoyed working with Glenn. And the other very short story that I'll tell, because I'm reminded of it a little bit by your remark about I didn't know I was writing a sports story. The one complaint I had about after I had everything that Glenn had sent me, I said, Glenn, this is 1998, and there's nothing in here about soccer. Now, I might have been the only prospective editor who would have said that in 1998, but I could see the women's team coming and everything, and I'd written about them back in 1991. And so I said, gee, shouldn't there really be something in here that has to do with soccer? So God bless Glenn. He went and found something. And it was a beautiful, beautiful story that ran in a magazine. What, it was up a regional magazine up in Maine or something?
Yeah, it was pretty obscure.
Yeah.
It was like the miracle of the early internet where you could find things online,
yeah.
And I'm like madly searching,
in the
databases at the library for soccer stories.
This woman had written this story about watching her child play soccer, mm-hmm. And it was beautiful in terms of the writing, and there was even a little bit of that sort of Latin American magical realism in it. It was just a stunning piece. And I said, he sent it to me, and I said, yeah, this needs to be in the book. And boy, was that woman surprised.
She was not only surprised, but she later made it in the book again for a story, a memoir she'd written about figure skating, which
yeah.
Underscores that whole writing about sports, not sports writing thing we were talking about before. And it also struck me when Nicole was talking, I had the good fortune to spend part of St. Patrick's Day this year with the sports writer Rick Tallender, mm-hmm. in a bar in Burlington, Vermont, where his son was going to, was playing lacrosse, and I was playing Irish music in a bar. And Bill and I, or Rick and I, sat together afterwards. We were talking sports writing, and at one point Rick said, let's face it, he says, none of this is, he says, we don't give a damn about sports. It's just an excuse to write about other things. Mm. And in many ways, I think that is so true. It's our entry point to write about other things. Yes, it's about sports, but at its best, it's also about something else.
Now, I know when I wrote a notes column on the NBA for years while working at the Globe, that it consumed me basically every day. Everything that happened, I tried to see if there's this a note. I mean, and then Friday put it together. But I'm always thinking, how much of your time is consumed on an annual basis in preparing for this?
In a loose way, sort of all of it.
Yeah.
Because
I'm not surprised to hear that.
I mean, I have to be aware all the time, and I do other things, and I write my own books, and I'm editing and acquiring material for a website now, and I'm looking at sports writing all the time in one way, shape, or another. But I've been doing it so long I tell everybody it's like the air. It's there when I get up. It's there when I go to bed. Stuff comes in the mail every day. And at this point, it's just part of the fabric. It's like farmers, you know, they get up, you got to milk the cow, and it's at a certain point
you come on, so he can see the experience.
At a certain point, you go to bed because, well, you have to get up and milk the cow the next day. That's sort of what it is. It's seamless. There's a big pile of stuff in the corner next to the stove, and my daughter's grown up with that.
Well, I just like to add that the numbers of people have told me how much they appreciate what you do.
Well, I appreciate what they do. Because if I didn't like it, this would be a horrible job.
I'm sure. But I know I read a lot of sports-related stuff, and I look forward to this book every year because there's always so much stuff in it that I haven't read,
that I have missed.
And I want to bring up a name of, you know, my favorite sports writer of all time, who's Bill Hines, wrote under the name W.C. Hines. I had the incredible good fortune to get to know Bill a little bit in the last years of his life. And he said to me, because he knew that Glenn and I had worked together and Glenn had done some work with him, he said, you know, the great virtue of this book is this is what young readers will read. And we got to get them reading. You know, and this is it. This is the kind of thing that they're going to read. So,
you know, I acquire and edit material now for a sports website, and a lot of the writers I work with are younger, and they come to me and they say, literally, I've been reading this my whole life. And they have. And they're like almost 30. And I'm not. You know, and that is very gratifying, though. You know, it's...
This anthology, as Glenn told you, is what, 25?
This is year 23.
Okay, 23 years old. Yeah. And prior to that, there was a previous incarnation, although there was no direct connection, but except in the spirit of the thing, called Best Sports Stories, which started in 1945. And this is your father's Best Sports Stories. You know? This is it. This is the 1955 edition. I happen to have four of them at home. Speaking to Bill's point about the readers, the point about the readers, I discovered this anthology back in prep school in the early 60s at the school library, and they had all the ones from 45 on at that time, and I devoured each and every one of them, fantasized someday about someday being in the book. And I finally made it. I made it to this book three times, thank God. I could die fulfilled now. I mean, when I made it, then, you know, it's just. But they're connected. I mean, they're not business connected, but these are connected. But speak to one thing, Glenn. When this just speaks to the changing world. When this anthology started in 45, 95% was about newspaper stories, and of those 95%. 80% were about deadline stories, people writing stories on deadline for newspapers. And maybe there were 15, and a couple of magazine stories, okay. Now, we've evolved to the point where I believe there are only two stories in here from newspapers at all, this year, out of 26 stories. And we have these stories about a number of sports. I did a breakdown of what what's in here. And actually, some of the stories are almost uncategorizable.
Yeah.
Seriously, I've just put them under the general heading of high school. There's some incredibly poignant and touching and powerful stories that have to do with high school, I can assure you. There's one story about a family that I could not categorize at all, the memoir one. I can't categorize it at all. Anyway, just to show how times have changed and how the concept of the book has changed, there's only one story in here at all that I would even label as a basketball story. There were five pertaining to football, but one of them only just barely. Anyway, I could go on and on. No, really. And there's a bullfighting story which leads off the book, and which is sensational. Would everybody agree to that? About a one-eyed bullfighter. I'm telling you, there's a reason why he has one eye. Okay.
And Karen Russell, the author, won a MacArthur Grant.
Oh my God!
About 2 weeks ago.
It's tremendous.
Deserved it.
It's right. Well, anyway, so Glenn, the fact could just speak to the idea of the changing world. This that I grew up on and wanted to be in, and this where. Nicole comes from a publication I do not know. The Believer. But she well deserves to be in here. So you can just speak to that evolution.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up with that other series, too. I remember it in my little town library, and it was one full shelf.
Yes, exactly.
And I read left to right. I read them all when I was a kid growing up. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the changes that have taken place in journalism over the last, particularly the last 10 to 15 years, have been dramatic and life-changing, I think, for everybody in this business, because it's not just newspapers anymore, and it's certainly not just magazines anymore, and the changeover is happening right now. I think there always are going to be newspapers and magazines, but the changeover to the online and the opportunities that come writing and publishing online, you know, there aren't quite as many gatekeepers. That's a good thing, and that's a bad thing. It can be both. It depends on the writer, depends on the people working with them. But it has expanded the base of what we consider loosely sports writing. Certainly there's more awareness of other sports than there used to be. I mean, when we grew up, it was baseball, football, basketball, hockey, and every 4 years the Olympics. And what, maybe boxing and maybe horse racing and tennis.
Horse racing was big. Well, yeah.
But now, you know, I mean, we've had curling stories in this book. We've had stories, you know, about Basques lifting big, heavy stones. I mean, the whole...
Bill
put that one in there.
Can I interrupt for just a second?
That was a softball.
That story had one of my favorite lines of all time. This is a sport where the whole thing is lifting big stones. So the writer is, I mean, you know what we do when we're doing actual sports writer things, we go up to athletes after they win and we say, how did that feel to win? Or we go up to athletes after they lose and say, how does it feel to have thrown that game and disappointed everybody? And that's what we do. So at one point in this wonderful story, the author goes up to this guy who weighs about 450 pounds and has just failed to lift this stone. He's got it on the... and he can't do it. And the guy goes up to him and he says, so what happened? How does it feel? What happened? And the guy says, the stone is very heavy. And I read that and I put down the story, and the tears were running down my eyes, and I thought, this may be the best line I ever read. I mean, Hemingway couldn't have written that line better.
I'm going to shift gears back a second. Jason, Curt Schilling is clearly a controversial personality. He always has been. He was in Philadelphia. What preconceived notion, if any, did you have, and how was it changed by your actual personal interaction with him?
You know, I have to say, meeting him and interviewing was totally bizarre because, you know, I'm a Red Sox fan. I grew up here. He made me very, very happy in 2004. So here I was meeting this guy, you know, and I, you know, it's like, all right, great. You know, I loved you on the Red Sox. Can we talk about all these lives you've ruined? So it was odd. It was odd also because he was very emotional about it. We were talking. He cried almost. It was right in the aftermath of it, so it was still a very emotional thing. Stan Grossfeld from The Globe later found out that he'd had a heart attack at some point during all this from the stress. But he was an open book. He was very honest. He was pretty self-delusional on some things. Mm-hmm. He has sort of this insane sense of confidence and optimism that sort of blind him to reality sometimes, it seems like, which is really, really great if you're a baseball player and not so great if you're running a business.
Yeah.
So he's a complicated guy.
Well, the way Jason ends it, I had to ask him before we came in here, is it safe to say he honestly believed, because of who he is and how he's wired, that he could have willed this project to success. No matter how dire things looked at any point in the process, that he was, in the end, I'm going to bloody sock this thing into existence, in other words.
Yeah, totally. He really, really thought, because he was good at baseball, he could do this. He thought the things he learned in baseball about what makes a successful person applied to business. Apparently that doesn't work. he also, I think an element of this is he had a lot of money involved. He had $50 million in the tank here. So it was in his interest to push this thing to the edge as far as he could get it. So that was part of it, too.
But the enormous confidence didn't. When I read it, I said, that's the current, on the cursory level that we ever get to know them, and just simply by covering them, that's the Kurt that I can relate to. I can relate to that guy, that he would have had that kind of confidence. I mean, this is basically down 13-0, bottom of the ninth, two strikes and two outs, but we're still going to win this game. That's big,
right.
Really.
One of the employees from the company I talked to called it rampant and destructive optimism. sort of the most interesting thing about him I learned reporting the story is he went into every meeting and walked out of it and thought he hit a home run. And they literally needed money. They needed investors to float the business. And literally every week they were having different investors in, week after week after week, and every time the investors walked out and said, "You guys crazy? Like, there's no way we're giving you money." This happened for 2 years. And every time he walked out of that meeting and thought, I nailed that. Like, that was great. They're definitely going to invest. And then one of the other employees had told me that, so I asked Kurt about it, like, expecting him to be like, "No, well, that's just how he's reading me. I was just trying to be enthusiastic." He's like, "Nope, that's me. That's how I am." So he's honest. He knows himself, He's an interesting guy.
Yeah. Nicole, what's it like for you to be in this book? What, tell me.
I'm pretty psyched about it. I mean, for the obvious reason that, it's a huge honor, but also because it's made me reconsider sports writing, right? Like, I think I totally get where Glenn and Bill are coming from, that these stories are not just deadline stories for papers, although I think I was guilty of that assumption about sports writing, too. And then when I started thinking back on it, it made so much sense. I mean, I love one book I read recently that I loved, Darcy Frey's The Last Shot, right? That's sports writing. That's unbelievably beautiful sports writing about so much more than basketball or teenagers or whatever. But so for me, I think it was really helpful to realize, like, oh, I mean, I love boxing. I could write about a boxer.
Sure.
Because, I mean, and I don't have to be a sports writer, but this can become a part of the kind of stories that these can become the kind of stories that I write more frequently.
Boxing's guys have been a traditionally great, rich incredibly rich. I remember being chided back 25, 30 years ago by the older guys on our staff that I should have paid more attention, to. They said, the stories are all there.
Yeah.
But that's the old days when they go to these training camps. They sit there for 6 weeks, literally, for these big bouts. The boxing's traditionally been well represented and Bill took care of it. Bill, you basically, and your capacity with Only a Game, which is celebrated its 20th anniversary, correct,
right,
this year? Okay. And if you don't listen to it, shame on you. Okay. You preordained the shift. I mean, you were right in the mainstream of the shift. I mean, you've had everything on Only a Game from, you get regular interviews with people with specific meat and potatoes. You've got your experts and that you rely on and you call. But I remember you did a thing on, he really did a piece on Quidditch.
Yep.
So this is like this whole concept. You're perfectly comfortable with the evolution of the writing concept.
Well, comfortable is a dangerous word, I concur with what people are saying. I think the best sports writing is just like the best writing, no matter what the subject is. It's writing that tells us something about what it's like to be alive on the planet. It's writing that puts us in some sort of connection with our fellow human beings and in some way enriches us because of that connection that is established by the writer and the partnership between the writer and the reader. It's a very risky thing, writing. It strikes me sometimes when I talk to athletes who are sometimes contemptuous of writers because a lot of the writers that they encounter are pests by nature of the interaction. And you can see, and some of them even say it, you don't take the risk. You write about the guy who makes the error, but you're not out there. You can't make the error. And they're wrong. Anybody who publishes, anybody who puts their stuff out there knows Yeah, I do make the error sometimes, and boy, do I hear about them. And sometimes writers make mistakes, and they pick the wrong word or whatever it might be, and we do hear about it. So there's a certain amount of risk, but the payoff, when you can sit back and look at something and say, well, I met this person, this man or this woman, and I saw him or her in the context of his or her work, and I got it. I got it. I said something about it that, in fact, is true of who they are and what they do and what it means. That's tremendously satisfying. And it doesn't matter whether you're writing about a surfer or a basketball player or a boxer or, in my case, the really important sports like skillet tossing and wife carrying.
One thing that strikes me annually is that there's one storyline in particular it's almost a can't-miss that people never run out of source material, and that's these high school stories. Mm-hmm. These high school stories, which would speak to all of us, obviously. We can relate to these things. And this year in particular, there's a couple. There's one about an incredible coincidental double death of brothers that are, this astonishing. But Glenn, in general, could you just, the high school stories, it just seemed that the university, they always come, you find
them. Yeah, they do always come. The interesting thing, and I think you're talking about the one where young man, there's another story in the book where young man made the last minute shot for his high school basketball team in the playoffs, and then he dies.
Died. No, that's another
like
one.
On the court. Amazing. And yes, there are stories like that every year. In fact, there's a lot of stories like that every year, but there are not those stories every year like the ones I think that are in the book that go from being, oh yeah, we've heard this kind of story before, to make it even what might be something of a commonplace topic or mem that make it something special, that make it immediate, that make it stand out in your life. So, there are perhaps to a degree a limited number of themes that you can ever write about, no matter what you're writing, whether it's sports or anything else. But I think what I look for and what every other editor of the Best American Series and any other collections do is you're looking for those stories that step out from the expected, where the writer is so engaged that they find something unique and special that make it possible for each of us to identify with something in that story ourselves. And, high school might make it a little bit easier because there's a certain purity there. Those athletes are not sullied yet. They're not doing it for money. They're not doing it for fame. They're doing it for their friends. Mm-hmm. They're doing it because, you can only be 17 and love something so much once.
No, I found,
and that's what I think makes them so effective.
One thing I found after 44 years is that of covering things is that guys, some of the most painful losses people ever had are still go back to the high schools. That they can reference those moments very, very quickly. Basketball players, the last second shots, or Larry Bird would go to his grave cursing Beezer Carnes because he missed one-on-ones and he wouldn't go to practice at 6 a.m. with everybody else to shoot free throws. And, things like that, No, it's true. It's out there. They were supposed to arrive before school and shoot free throws. And Beezer was reluctant to do so. And sure enough, who got fouled with a big one-on-one in the sectional game? Beezer. And who missed? Beezer. So, it's true, There's a go. I have to point out, too, that it's all the stories, and if you're unfamiliar with the book, and of course, available for purchase, outside, and for signing afterwards.
Great for Christmas.
Of course, great for Christmas. Perfectly in time for Christmas and as well. But there are some really empirical stories. Like, there's a story that I particularly like that's about the shocking, even you think you know, but you don't know, depth of pain-killing addiction that NFL players have post-career. It's a very disturbing story if you happen to be a devotee of the National Football League. It kind of have to make you reconsider your fidelity to this product, believe me. So it's not just a matter of personality profiles or of that. It's a wide-ranging anthology and 26 stories. We were hoping that you might have some questions for our panelists, and the time has come. If we can produce, we do have a microphone available. And okay, there we go. We have one in the rear. I'll get to you, sir, next. Right in the rear.
Great. Thank you very much. I think I can speak for many of us in the room to say thank you for your work. I get it for Christmas every year, and it's just terrific stuff. I'd like to ask you, since you have a view of the arc of this anthology, as sports has become more important in the national conversation, how has sports writing become more important, or has it, and why?
To whom specifically? Who wants to, anybody want to?
Bill, maybe?
Yeah.
I think the writing can lead the way with a lot of the contemporary concerns. I mean, we see League of Denial, which aired a couple weeks ago. A number of sports writers led the way before the Mark and Steve Faneroo. Before they did, there were all these other writers that broke that story in increments and incrementally built this case that there might be an issue. That's, I think, a perfect example of the kind of role that writers can play in this industry. It's not a passive role, as it may have once been, where you're just reacting to the games. It's much more interactive and participatory in that regard.
I think that's true. I think the expectations are greater. I think more and more people are becoming involved in telling stories, and it's partly as a result of what Glenn has talked about. It used to be that you had to get a job at a newspaper or become a magazine writer or get a contract to write a book. Now anybody with an opinion can put it out there and start a blog and get on a website and all the rest of it. And as Glenn suggested earlier, some of it's awful, it's unreadable. But some of it's good, and some of what's good might not have found its way into everybody's, before there were, everybody had an iPad or an iPhone or a computer, or might not have seen it. So I think the expectations are greater because of what people have been taught to anticipate because of so much being out there. But I don't think that the general act of storytelling and the general act of reporting have changed very much. And I don't think, you know, it's interesting. Before coming over here, I was at a panel at a college celebrating the 40th anniversary of the college's literary magazine. And people were talking about, oh, you know, how do we organize to keep the writers writing, and how do we collect their writing, and how do we produce the magazine, and which faculty members should be doing this, that, and the other thing. And I just sat there saying, it doesn't need to be organized. Writers write, and a certain number of people are going to feel the impulse to be storytellers, and they're going to go find stories, they're going to tell them, and a certain number of them are going to tell them so well that we're going to read them and remember them, and that's never going to change. It was probably happening when the stories were told in a series of punctuated grunts, and it's still happening now. So it's built in. It's you know, it's part of the package, and I don't worry about it. It's going to come. I don't know exactly what the format's going to be, but it's going to come, and people will always tell stories, and they'll always want to hear them and read them. So I'm not too concerned about that part.
You have a question?
Maybe following up on what you've just said, a new phenomenon, it seems to me, is the multimedia writer or sports person. It used to be that newspaper writers were newspaper writers, and radio and television personalities were radio and television personalities. Now you see a lot of crossover, particularly the Globe writers and the Herald writers, are all over the radio and TV. Do you think that changes the way they do their work, the way they do their writing, the way they do their storytelling, and how will that impact in the long run on how we see sports?
Well, speaking as one of those people...
I noticed that.
I would say that the only issue that I ever found was, there were two. The obvious one is if you get a scoop, you get an item, you have to save it for the paper. You don't blab it on EEI at 4 p.m. I used to say you put it in the morning paper. Now, of course, you post it. You know, it's all different. That's a whole other topic we could discuss for hours. Second thing is just your time. You know, you got to budget your time. You got to remember where your priorities are. And that's the issue, as far as I'm concerned. Now, someone else may have a different slant on this. But you're right about the Globe. Bud Collins pioneered this back literally 52 years ago, 51 years ago in the 62, I think, is the first year he did some commentary for Channel 2 about tennis. And that eventually became his life. his primary means of earning a living. And he kind of pioneered it as much as anybody in America, frankly, a high level. And he was a great columnist. Everybody knows him as a tennis writer. He was a spectacularly brilliant daily columnist who happened to have certain specialties, tennis, boxing, etc. But anyway, so that's the issue. But it is a phenomenon that is completely, when I started it, believe me, the last thing, nowhere on the radar screen was the idea of any kind of a concurrent career in radio or television that would that would occupy my time as opposed to spending all of it as a sports writer. And that's just the way it evolved for me and a lot of us. And that's just, that was unforeseen. Reason, the insatiable appetite for airtime. For you got to fill space. They have to put things on the air and put things on radio, and they realized that writers had information, and hence the start of the information people. You know, the Chris Mortensons and the John Claytons and the Adam Schefters are all expatriate newspaper people, all three of them, and they're typical, and that's who these people are. Question: this gentleman, yeah, right there, it was right, yes, sir.
Hello, I'd like to have you cheer me up a little bit. the Celtics. Okay. Our coach is on the West Coast. Okay. I can't even watch him on TV because of the time change. Okay. The big three that were there are gone. Rondo, he didn't even play last year hardly. Okay. So what do I have to look forward to and be excited about the Celtics, the Boston team?
All right. First of all, your big three, you got 5 years out of a three-year plan on two of them, and 6 years out of a three-year plan on two of them, and 5 years out of a three-year plan on one of them. So we were blessed to have them as long as we had them. Okay, that's my take on that. Doc didn't leave comfortably and smoothly. I wish he had handled it better. Okay, but there it is. This year they're not. Look, at the best case scenario is that they're somewhat better than we think, and they will contend for the eighth spot in the playoffs and get beaten and swept in the first round, and be left out of the lottery, and have no, and no, and you know, and consign themselves to a, you know, to a cycle of mediocrity for the foreseeable future, probably no longer than your great grandchildren. Okay.
Tell us what you really think, Bob.
No. I do that's if that materializes. If we're lucky, they won't make the playoffs, and it will be bad enough to be among the bottom five or six. And it's a bountiful crop of youngsters. And if they get lucky, you know, they might even get one of them. It's a big draft. 2014 is a big draft. Okay, big draft for the bad teams is going to be help for everybody. For about six or seven teams, they're going to get definite help. I don't have a good now, but the issue, I don't know. Hey, you can't get greedy. Come on.
Come on. Where's your baseball team?
Can't get greedy.
Oh, that's right. They're one game away, one win away from making the World Series
just
again.
Just remember, nobody, no city in America comes close to the sharing the bounty that we've had since 2000. We know nobody's come close to us. One of my friends is here from the most forlorn city in America, Cleveland. And you know, just remember, I used to say to people before the Red Sox ever won in 2004 that just think about your cousin in Cleveland, okay? And they haven't won anything since 1964, and that's it. And so, come on. Anyway, Brad Stevens, I'll jump right to the chase on that. Brad Stevens, the only thing I can say about this, he's trying to fight, contradict a run of failure that college coaches who have had no ties to the NBA coming to the league have had for about 30 years. But if anybody can do it, the belief is that he's the one that can do it. He has an enormous reservoir of endorsements from people both inside college basketball and in the NBA. They think he's the prodigy that can do it, so we'll see. I don't know. Yeah. No. Question. Anybody else? Yes.
No. I'm sorry. One real quick question. Charlie Pierce appears on your show every week. He seems to have gone...
All Charlie's relatives appear to be in attendance.
He seems to have gone the other way, starting in sports and I think branching away from sports. Has he made his way into the anthology and...
Oh, just yeah. There. Yeah, as a matter of fact, Charlie, for a while, was the most thoroughly anthologized writer.
Yeah, he and Gary Smith for a while were running neck and neck. And then Charlie started writing other stuff.
Yeah, and I took huge heat in 1998 because Glenn sent me two pieces by Charlie, and I put them both in the book. and people said, oh, yeah, you're just putting it because you talk to him every week on Only a Game. And I said, no, I'm putting them in because they're two of the best pieces I got. They were great. One was a long of thoroughly celebrated piece, as a matter of fact, since about Tiger Woods, mm-hmm. which some of you may be familiar with. That was the story where Charlie was doing a story, a big story for GQ, and he was trying to get some time with Tiger Woods. And finally, the handlers for Tiger Woods said, okay, you can ride in the limo with him from the hotel to the site where they're going to do this photo shoot, fashion shoot, with a bunch of models and Tiger. And Charlie got in the car, and he sat quietly in the corner while Tiger told racist jokes to the models and scribbled notes. And Tiger looked at him at one point and said, hey, you can't write that stuff down. And Charlie said, too late. And the resultant story split the sports writing community. Actually, I was going to say in half, but it wasn't in half. About 85% of the sports writing community regarded Charlie Pierce as a nasty little SOB for doing what he did, because they felt that it was part of their responsibility to protect Tiger Woods. And the other 15% said, hey, all he did was sit in the car and write down what the guy said. And nobody ever said off the record. And so there was the story. So that was one of the story. And the other one was a story called Big Game, which was a little short column-length story about why Charlie loved going into places where the big game was happening. And it didn't matter whether it was a college basketball game or a high school football game. It was the game that captured the imagination of everybody in the town or the area. And they all went, and they always all went, and they wore the same shirts. And they, you know, and he just was, he didn't care where he was. If there was a big game, he wanted to go. Even if he didn't have a stake, he loved the phenomenon of it. And I put both of those in, and I every once in a while I still hear about it. You know, what the hell kind of editor are you? You put in two stories by Charlie Pierce.
And I always blame the guest editor.
Yeah,
but he's always been a hybrid. While with the Phoenix, he wrote politics and sports. He's always been a hybrid. He may be as good a purveyor of prose as there is in America today. I mean, his writing is impeccable, and whether you agree with his political viewpoint is another matter. But his writing is impeccable, and he's sui generis. I think he stands apart somehow from anybody else in the business and in the way he goes about things. That's endorsement. Unsolicited. And other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll add that story about Tiger Woods. I think is maybe my favorite story of any magazine story ever, sports or otherwise. And I read it actually after the scandal. Everything we learned, you know, what Tiger does in his free time. It sort of melts your brain. He was the only person in America who was on top of this, and it's really, if you haven't read it, you should really. It's pretty incredible.
It's a great story. Yeah, it's a great story.
Yes, back there.
I'm not sure if I got it right, but I believe there was a story by Dan Shaughnessy, who I know is not here, but was it about you sitting next to Bill Belichick on the plane?
Not me.
Okay. So whatever that story was, my wife said it was the funniest story she'd ever read, and she doesn't even read the
sports
pages.
Oh, I think he concocted a scenario. It was a scenario that he concocted. A fictional sting, you know. I'm searching for a catch-all word here that fails me, but an invented, you know, proposed scenario. It wasn't a real thing. Never happened.
Right.
No, you know what I mean. Anyway, it wasn't real. That was okay. Yes, we got. All right, we'll do about three more. Yeah, okay, three. We have some over here.
Since we started earlier about the Tiger Woods, as sports writers, reporters, how do you feel about tearing down America's idols, telling the truth or trying to glean some interest in, say, Michael Jordan, Kobe, especially in this town? How do you feel about that? How do you come across?
How do you feel about the tearing down of...
Well, we like hearing about them. We like pulling these people up in pedestals.
No.
And as we just said about, you know, Tiger Woods, someone has to report about it and gets villainized.
This is a good thing we got a simple question here at the end.
So we can take it up afterwards. No. Yeah, no. The theory, people do believe that people, the writer or the media consciously builds people up for the express purpose of someday taking them down. I reject that thoroughly. I don't think that's the idea. But they generally do themselves in, frankly. They do themselves. Look at A-Rod. I mean, go back to the concept of A-Rod 10 years ago, coming out of Seattle when he signed with Texas, and what the concept of him is now as a person. I mean, that's one rather glaring example. Michael Jordan, we always knew, was a little had interesting, nasty quirks, okay? No one ever made, he's the only person I know that ever was inducted into a Hall of Fame and used it to settle public scores and made it a sour experience. And that, to me, that tells you who he really is. We didn't do it, he did it. I mean, I don't want to get too defensive on this subject.
Look at Schilling.
Yeah, and I'd add on Michael Jordan, I think one of the best sports stories of this year so far was in ESPN Magazine. Ray Thompson wrote about Michael Jordan and this way that totally thoroughly complicated him. And really, you know, you get to see sort of what makes him tick in a way that makes you understand some of these negative mm-hmm. things and maybe not like them better, but sort of understand where they're coming from and what makes this guy go. So I think there's, you know, more than maybe just the backstabbing out there, hopefully.
Well, so. And it's what do you do, not report it?
Yeah.
You see mm-hmm. it and you don't report it?
As Bill said, it's a very complex question. I'd be happy to take up more, you know, after we're done here. But we are, not amazingly, out of time, a very quick 60 minutes. So I wanted you to join me in thanking. I want to thank Nicole Pasolka. Jason Swart. Bill Littlefield, and the Grand Poobah of Best American Sports Writing, which, by the way, is available for purchase and signing. Also, would you be so kind as to fill out the survey cards, and you can turn all your devices back on now. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Bob. Can you